You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's show is sponsored by AppRiver. Folks, have you seen all the news about emails being stolen or about companies getting big fines for not complying with privacy laws? Well, that doesn't have to happen to your business. Talk with our friends at AppRiver about CipherPost Pro, an advanced email encryption platform that keeps your mail secure from sender to receiver. Keep control of your message with CipherPost Pro from AppRiver. Check it out at appriver.com/kick. Again, that's appriver.com/kick. We're also sponsored by Nadex. What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? That way, you could try day trading the markets without worrying about the risk. Well, luckily, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. That's Nadex, Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Call him crude, call him obnoxious, call him annoying, but you can't say he isn't funny, and you certainly can't call him dull. And for my money, Gilbert Gottfried is one of the funniest people on the planet. Whether he's telling stupid dad jokes about turtles or bluer material that would make a friar's roast blush, Gilbert just loves to laugh and to make others laugh with him. He's been doing it almost his whole life since he took the stage at his very first open mic night at age 15. And though his memorable roles in Beverly Hills Cop 2, Problem Child 1 and 2, Look Who's Talking, and Disney's Aladdin have made him an instantly recognizable face and voice to people of all ages, Gilbert's first love still remains comedy. Utterly fearless on stage, he's almost universally respected and loved by his fellow comics, who praise him as the comedian's comedian. Now he's the subject of a revealing, hilarious, and surprisingly endearing documentary called Gilbert, A Gilbert Gottfried Story. And today Gilbert returns to the podcast to talk about the movie, his career in comedy, and his surprisingly normal life behind the scenes. He recalls some of the worst gigs he's ever had, reveals why he used to look down on comics who work dirty, and he tells the one joke that his wife absolutely hates. He talks about his hesitation to let a documentary crew film his life and why he's terrified that being seen as a great husband and father and an all-around wonderful human being is going to completely ruin his career. Plus, Nazis love Gilbert, traveling salesman jokes, impressions of everyone from Humphrey Bogart at the post office to Jackie Gleason in Casablanca, and I finally let Gilbert tell his infamous Danny Thomas story on the air. Coming up with the hilarious Gilbert Gottfried in just a moment. Today I'm joined again by one of the funniest men alive, Gilbert Gottfried. He's the subject of a new documentary called Gilbert, A Gilbert Gottfried Story, which opens November 3rd in New York and November 10th in L.A. Gilbert, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
In the great tradition of documentarians like Werner Herzog, the Maisel brothers, and Michael Moore, and Gilbert, we get to see you wash your socks and underwear in a sink.
Yes. I was really wanted to hold out for Ken Burns to like a few nights of my life. Mm-hmm. And it would all be in black and white.
Any awards buzz yet?
Oh, yes.
You know, it's an interesting documentary because we kind of get to go behind the scenes, behind the persona of Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah, it's horrible for me to watch. I look at the film and I cringe because I'm okay as Joe the Plumber on a sitcom or something. But me as me, I go, oh God, what is that?
You afraid this is going to cost you money?
Always. That's what I'm thinking of 24 hours a day.
I mean, in all seriousness, were you nervous about letting people in behind the curtain and see your life with your kids and your wife?
There's not one screaming? Part, and I've said this a lot. I always think of that scene in Wizard of Oz. You know, ignore that man behind the curtain. And so, yeah, I hated the idea of, and I'm one of those people who, you know, if someone asks me what's my favorite ice cream, I'm like, I don't want to talk about it because that's a secret that I'm keeping.
Well, you know, I was just talking with your lovely wife. The audience kind of gets to know her a little bit in this movie. My girlfriend, who enjoyed the film way more than she expected to, said, being Gilbert's wife kind of seems like being the mother of an autistic son. Is that a little bit on point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a little extra work.
How did you guys meet?
How did
this relationship start?
She used to be in the music business. Mm-hmm. Like getting records played on the air or tapes or
Paola.
8 tracks. And I was invited to some Grammy party by some guy I knew from the record business. And I still call it the record business. That's
you know. Okay. Records are coming back now. LP sales.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So I'm really much hipper.
Yeah.
Than I come across.
Yeah, and you're the guy who's still selling DVDs after
oh
your
act.
Oh my
God! Too. Yes, yes.
That comes out in the show. Well, I think she said something like, on your first date, you walked her home and you spent an hour telling her turtle jokes, and that's how you won her heart.
Yes. Yeah. I wish I would have known that turtle jokes are that powerful all these other years.
How much turtle material do you have?
Oh, I specialize in it. Well, a snail is attacked by a turtle. And the police show up, and the policeman says, "What happened?" And the snail goes, "I don't know. It all happened so fast."
And that's what did it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Did you date much before that? Because all your friends say that this came as a shock to them. Just one day
yes.
You said, "I'm getting married and having a baby."
That's how shockingly secret my life is, where I won't even say, you know, who's a friend of mine, that guy's a friend of mine, or dating someone or anything. It's like the documentary starts off with the time I went on the Howard Stern show, which I've been on a billion times.
Yeah.
And then he goes, and he's in shock. And he's like, wait a minute, you got married and you're having a kid? This was all, like, I kept it a secret up until then. I remember leaving the show that day after that was revealed to the world. And I remember just shaking because it's, anything about my private life.
Yeah. Did it become real, I guess, at that moment for you a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was your hesitation? You know, what took you so long to settle down? Was just you didn't see yourself in that kind of role?
Yeah. I mean, I still, and I talk, that also I talk about in the film, where I feel like still my life's a Twilight Zone episode. And it's one of those episodes where the guy wakes up and he goes, "Where am I?" And someone says, "Why, you're in the White House, Mr. President." "And what year is it?" "Why, it's 1403, sir."
Yeah, it's a little bit like It's a Wonderful Life in reverse, where suddenly you wake up and you have this perfect life with wife and kids and all that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, Dara kind of rats you out a little bit in this film. She claims that you used to only work clean and even looked down on comics who worked dirty. Is that true?
It was, well, I didn't so much look down on them as I used to avoid dirty just because I wanted to see if the joke worked on its own.
Huh.
Because a lot of times I would see a comic on TV where, say, the punchline was, "And I ate a sandwich." And you go, oh. And then I would think about it and go, oh, so the producers of this show saw him in a club and he said, "So I ate a fucking sandwich." And they said, "That's a great joke." And they said, "Well, of course you can't say fucking, but the joke itself still works." And it's like, no, it really doesn't.
Are there jokes that Dara doesn't like of yours?
Oh, yes. Several. One in particular that she spoke to the filmmaker, Neil Berkeley. She told him a few times, "Cut this out of the film. I don't want any, I don't want a second of this in the film." I do a whole bit about Mackenzie Phillips' autobiography. And she used to, her father used to have sex with her. So you could only imagine where the bit is headed. And, but meanwhile, I did it with Kelly Ripa, and she loved it.
No. You did it?
And I used to do it on the Mike Douglas show. And no, it's...
I love the line that you have, because what was it you said? You know, "I can't even get my daughter to hold my hand crossing the street."
Yeah.
So what changed? When did you stop working clean and this became you?
I don't know exactly, but... And I always had that fascination with doing jokes you're not supposed to make.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, don't joke on that topic. And so that started coming out more and more to varying degrees.
And you started pretty early on. I mean, at an incredibly young age, I think, right?
Yeah. First time I got up on a stage, it was... My sister had found out from a friend of hers that there was some club where you could just show up. They had a stage, and you wrote your name down on the list. And when they got to your name, they called you, and you went up on stage. And I was 15 years old, and I was mainly doing imitations.
Were you funny at 15?
Outside
of the living room?
Yeah. It was one of those things like, well, I always say, I don't know if I was funny or I was bombed and I was too stupid to know better. But it was very much like when they used to have impressionists on TV all the time. Now you don't see them.
Yeah, that's true.
And but they used to be, Frank Ocean, Rich Little, Fred Travellina, Marilyn Michaels. And and the act was pretty much like that. So, imagine if your waiter was so-and-so.
Oh, yeah. They would have these terrible setups.
They
would announce, "I'm going to do an impression pretty much of so-and-so," and then do it.
And I always liked, Well, I always liked the ones that couldn't do the actor, so they did an impression of a character that the actor played. Like, you know, imagine if your waiter was Al Pacino, the way he was in Scarface. Imagine if your lawyer was Dustin Hoffman, the way he was in Rayman. And then there were other impressions that everyone, they don't even introduce it as the way they were in, because you already accept that that's who they are when they're not. To this day, if someone does a John Travolta, it's basically, Mr. Carter.
Yeah.
And he doesn't talk like that.
Yeah, or when they do Carson, they're doing... Who's Carson are they doing?
Oh, Rich Little?
Yeah, or the Nixon is who's Rich
David
Nixon.
Fry.
David Fry, that's right.
Oh, and when they do Keanu Reeves, it's like always from Bill and Ted's Adventure, you know?
Now, you did really obscure impressions when you started out. You would do like these character actors from the 1940s.
Yeah, like I always liked doing imitations of, like John MacGyver.
And I'm trying to picture him.
Yeah. He was like sort of short, little on the chubby side, bald. And like he would always play these buffoonish authority figures, like, you know, hotel managers and whatnot. And it was always like, "Everything must be run according to schedule. We will have no slackers working here. I run this hotel like I run a ship."
Or like Sydney Greenstreet, would that be one of the ones that you would do back then?
Yes, you are a character, sir. I enjoy talking to a man who enjoys to talk. I distrust close-mouthed men.
I think one of the ones that you got famous for early on, and it's one of my favorites, is when you do Jackie Gleason as Rick in Casablanca instead of Bogey. And it totally changes the whole chemistry of the script.
You're getting on that plane with Vic Laszlo. You're getting on that plane, all right? And I know that you know that I know that you're getting on that plane.
So you completely turn that scene from Casablanca from Rick doing some noble gesture to a threat, basically.
Oh, yes.
And I think that you do supposedly the world's shortest impression, right? Isn't that Bogey?
Oh, I do a bunch of short impressions. Okay. Well, I do Humphrey Bogart in the post office.
Yeah.
Stamp. And I do Bela Lugosi when he's not wearing a watch, but you ask him what time it is.
What time is it?
10.
The comics who came up with you say that you would do these impressions, and whether the audience was on board or not with you, you would double down. And if they weren't on board, you would just get even more defiant.
Yeah. And I used to do Jerry Seinfeld when he was just another comic hanging around the clubs and hadn't appeared on TV. And I used to imitate him. And in the back of the room, the audience would be scratching their heads because he wasn't
known. Yeah, who is he?
And like the other comics and waitstaff would be cracking up. And Seinfeld would be out in the bar pacing back and forth angrily going, "That doesn't sound anything like me."
Now, I had Bud Freeman on a few weeks ago. Did you ever work his club, the Improv, in the old days?
Yeah, and how I was never shot or any, because that's when Times Square was Times Square.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so you'd walk through Times Square, you know, at night, and then this was on a side street on 44th and 9th, and that was a dangerous place. But I worked the improv a bunch of times, and I would go there every night and hang out. Yeah.
Did he ever pay you?
No.
What was your first paying gig where you realized, hey, maybe I can make a career out of this?
It was so weird. One, they told me about they were doing a show of old places, the basement of a church.
What?
And
that's your perfect venue.
Yes, yeah, that's my audience. And I worked there. I did a show, and I got paid $7, which I thought was I hit the jackpot. And then about a year later, I performed there again, and that time I got $5. So my value keeps going down.
Now, your dad may have been, I think, the only Jewish handyman other than Jesus.
Yeah.
He was not fully on board with your stand-up career, right?
No. And now I totally understand that feeling. I can only imagine what was going through my parents' heads. Because back then, to say you're going to be a comedian, that's like saying, well, I'm going to support myself. I'm going to buy a lottery ticket and win $1 billion. And, insane. It's like saying, I'm going to be the next Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, that's what David Steinberg told me. He said when you guys were coming up, that was before the 80s comedy boom, wasn't it? I mean, or in large part.
Actually, what David Steinberg said.
It was a joke, pretty much, to be a comedian.
What David Steinberg said was, when we were coming up, it was before the 80s comedy boom.
Now, was he someone who you... Well, he probably predated you, right? He probably came up before you.
I remember watching him on TV, like the Smothers Brothers, and he used to host the Tonight Show sometimes. And then years later, I wind up doing an episode of Mad About You, and he was the director.
He was directing, yeah.
And there was one scene where I have to say something and then run off. So I do the scene, I say something, and then I run off. And he says to me, can you do that again, but run a little faster? And so I said, yeah, I could run faster. And he goes, no, I don't mean faster necessarily, but a little more graceful. And I said, graceful? And he goes, yeah, not so much of a bouncy, choppy kind of. And then he just threw his hands up in the air, and he goes, can you run less Jewish? And I knew immediately.
Yeah, it made sense.
Yeah,
you got it.
Yeah.
I mean, every comedian in this thing seems to say that they love you both as a comic and a person, and they all call you a comics comic. That shocked me because I'm used to hearing about comics, being backbiting, trashing each other, and jealous. Have you never had that kind of a rivalry or a comedian that you didn't
sure
get along with in your career?
Yeah. I mean, no one's like universally liked. Well, except me, of course. Yeah. But it's, and especially with comics, I heard this line. I don't know whose line it is, but he said, how many comedians does it take to screw in a light bulb? 100. One to screw in a light bulb and 99 to say, how did he get a light bulb? He sucks.
Did you ever feel that kind of jealousy when you were
starting
of other comics?
And I remember in my early, early days when there were still other impressionists trying to be impressionists, I'd go, oh, God, that guy's doing some of the same impressions I do. And I go, oh. And there was also that thing, even, when I watch a comic, I've been doing it so long, where it's like I don't laugh so much as go, ah, yeah, that's clever. Yeah, okay.
Someone recently told me that Larry David's like that. Ooh, I can't remember who it was, said that they were on Curb Your Enthusiasm, Seinfeld, on Seinfeld. And Bryan Cranston told me this.
Oh.
He said he was on Seinfeld and he would do something funny that Larry liked, but he wouldn't laugh. He would just kind of nod his head, and it was like he recognized comedy,
yes,
but it wouldn't make him laugh.
Yes. Yeah.
He's another one that you knew coming up, right?
He
was another one who would clear the room when he got on stage sometimes.
He would go up, and if there was like one person who was not laughing or looking at their watch or something, he'd start yelling at them. And challenging them to a fight outside.
That's a great way to win people over. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with the hilarious Gilbert Gottfried when we come back in just a minute. Today's episode is sponsored by Sonos. Folks, I can't tell you what a fan I am of my new Sonos speakers. Last weekend, I had some friends over, and they couldn't believe the kind of sound I was getting out of my Sonos Play 5 speaker and how intuitively it worked with all my music apps. They all wanted to play with it and see how it works, sync up their own music with my Sonos speaker, and after that night, a couple of them ordered Sonos speakers for themselves the very next day. Heck, I like it so much I even got a second Sonos speaker for my office, because Sonos is the Einstein of smart speakers. Sonos lets you have pulse-pounding sound in any room or every room all at once. That's right. Play a different song in the living room, bedroom, even bathroom, or play the same track in every room. Add your existing music services or discover something new. Whether curated or on demand, free or subscription-based, Sonos has you covered with access to a growing list of music services. Plus, Sonos' simple app lets you control everything from songs to volume to rooms all in one place. And now, Sonos is offering Kick-Ass News listeners 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. That's a savings of up to $250. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Just visit Sonos.com and use the promo code NEWS10. Again, if you want to receive this special offer, go to Sonos.com and use that special promo code NEWS10, NEWS in all caps, 10. I love my new Sonos speakers, and I know you're going to love them too. And now, back to the podcast. Do you still like performing and going on the road and that whole thing?
Oh, God, it's... Whenever my agent calls and says, oh, there's a new club that wants you out in so-and-so, I always cringe. I get sick. I am angry. I'm depressed. And I always try to remind myself, well, like, oh, so you're getting this upset because you're in demand in show business.
Yeah.
People want to pay you to fly to their state so they can see you.
Yeah, I think you said that you have a fantasy that they call that yes. Call and cancel on you, huh?
Yeah, whenever I'm about to go on stage, I always have this fantasy that the manager will come back and go, we just had a fire or a flood, but here's your check. So now you can go home. I think I'd like to make my whole career.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be a little bit different now that you have kids and a wife and all that to go the road that much. But do you still enjoy being on stage? Because you joke around about hating it. And, you know, if you could, you would never go on stage and you'd just do voiceover. But is there still a part of you that has that need to be in front of an audience?
I guess so. And I guess it's also like the old saying, dance with the one who brought you.
Yeah.
And it's like, so stand-ups, the one that brought me.
And then tweet about them.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the last time we talked a little bit about that, the whole Aflac fiasco, yeah, when you got fired for the tweets after the Japanese tsunami. But after watching this movie, it sounds like, you know, you were this was a serious setback to your career. Were there some lean years or months after all that?
It was really weird because, like, in front of my house, there would be these photographers and reporters just camping out there.
Really?
And I was constantly getting hatred on the internet. And they were talking about me on the internet, on news shows. And what I started to realize is, you know, at first I would get depressed when they go, our top story, Gilbert Gottfried's career is officially over. And then what I realized is, if your career is over, they don't mention you anymore, and you sure as hell are not their top story.
Yeah, that's true.
And so it really proves the old adage, as long as they're talking about you.
Yeah, and you were kind of groundbreaking with these tweets. I mean, you might be able to run for president now.
Oh yes.
This is some new territory that you charted. Now, have you learned your lesson, or does your wife, Dara, have to take away your phone every time there's a hurricane this summer?
Yeah, I like I always said, I think twice now, but I do it anyway.
You have this weird dichotomy because you're this stand-up who does dirty dick jokes and, you know, the aristocrats.
As opposed to the clean dick jokes.
Yeah.
I do some wholesome dick jokes, too.
Okay, good point. But you also voiced, you know, the parrot from Aladdin and tons of children's cartoons. Does Disney or any of these other animation companies, do they ever worry that you're going to hurt their image?
It's surprising.
It's a weird pairing.
Like, I lost the Duck account, but I still will get hired to do parrot stuff, you know. And it's
you
like
play a lot of birds.
My favorite job that I got was after Aladdin had been out years ago. They called me up and they said, you know, we're making God knows what, a video game, a computer game, whatever.
Oh, yeah, it's never ending.
Yeah, and I don't even know. And so I went to the, you know, sound place, the recording place, and I said, no one ever sent me a script for what I am going to be doing. And they said, oh, we just need the parrot laughing. And I said, that's it? And he goes, yeah. And they close the door, click on the mic, and I go, ha-ha! And they go, that's great. Okay, thanks a lot.
That's a dream gig.
Yeah, that. And I thought, I wish every one of my jobs was like that.
Now, what are some of the worst gigs that you've had to do? I mean, at some point, you must have had some really terrible venues and audiences over the years.
I remember working in Canada, in Ottawa, and Ottawa's known even for Canadians as being a cold place. And now they were having some major snowstorm. And I was playing there for a week, and I remember you had to do three different 20-minute sets to the same crowd.
What? Why?
Yeah. And there'd be pauses in between the sets, so to give the audience a chance
to forget.
Yeah, to die down.
Was this an Alzheimer's home or something?
Yeah, it's like, and I remember, you know, shitty sound system, and the woman who managed the place tried to go to the mic and introduce me, and she was too nervous to be in front of an audience and went backstage and yelled out, here he is, Gilbert Gottfried. And, you know, and I would bomb the first show and bomb the second show and bomb the third. And by the end of the week, I didn't give a fuck. I knew the audience hated me. So I started doing anything that popped into my head. And the first set, I did an hour and a half because I was just filled with. And then the second set, I did an hour. And just because I was going crazy up there, anything that popped. And the third set, I did 15 minutes. And when I got off stage, the manager says, "You did a little short that time."
Now, did you ever have to do these corporate gigs like a Pepsi distributor's retreat or something?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Those are the worst, aren't they?
Yeah, because corporate, you know, nobody is there to watch a comic. They want to get totally shit-faced and pray that there's a bus that's going to take them all to a strip club. You know?
Do you have to change your act for those kind of things? Or do you do those much anymore?
Yeah.
Because they pay well.
Yeah, they do pay well. Yeah. But, I don't think, you know, those workers on a day off really want to hear, you know, "Hey, you ever get on a bus and the bus driver is..."
Well, yeah, speaking of that, there's a scene in this movie where you end up performing at a fundraiser for St. Jude's Children's Hospital.
Yes.
Now, you go on after these parents who are talking about their kids who died of leukemia and everyone's sobbing. Yeah. How the hell do you follow something like that?
That was I did two benefits for St. Jude's.
And I should point out that you did it out of the kindness of your heart.
Yeah.
You did it complimentary. You're a good soul.
Yeah. And I went there and I remember talking to one of the managers of the place, and they would have like these photos of children with bald heads. And then before I went on, there was like a father talking about when his daughter was just, something was wrong, and she was sleeping too much and couldn't eat. And then she was diagnosed with cancer. And he talks tearfully about having to drive his child to a hospital for cancer treatment.
Wow.
And this guy, and then it was, "Ladies and gentlemen, a real funny man, Gilbert Gottfried." And I thought, okay, this is what's going to end my career. Yeah. This is where it will officially end. And I went up, and I was doing dick jokes and blowjob jokes. And the audience loved it.
Really?
And they were all laughing and applauding. And I did great. And it just proves that, you know, in these situations where it's tragic and sad, people have a need to laugh more than ever then.
Yeah, that's for sure.
They don't want to take that all in. They want to laugh at that stuff.
Well, you know who founded St. Jude's, right? Danny Thomas. Did you tell your Danny Thomas story?
Surprisingly, no.
No. I hesitated last time. Do you want to tell us the Danny Thomas story now?
Okay, I might as well.
This is an old Hollywood legend. I don't know where you came across this.
Yes. I've heard it a few different times.
Yeah.
That what Danny Thomas was into was that he'd lie underneath a glass coffee table and women would be on the table taking a shit on it. One time I heard a variation of it where they said for some reason he dressed up as a priest when he did this.
Oh, really?
I only heard that once, but I thought, wow, that's even worse taste. And so that's what, and I don't know when he woke up and said, it sounds. And the other one I always like to tell is the Cesar Romero.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was in movies, a Latin lover and a macho guy. And he was gay in real life. And he was best known to people of younger, my generation, for being the Joker on Batman.
Right, right.
And what he was into was he'd gather up, a whole bunch of boy toys, and then he'd stand in front of them, pull down his pants and underwear, bend over as they would throw orange wedges at his ass. Some people argue it was tangerine wedges. You know, it was some citrus fruit. And that was another one of those. When do you wake up and go, hey, you know, I'd like to be hit in the ass with an orange? That would certainly.
Yeah, he should have gotten like a sponsorship from Sunkist or something for that.
But in all those years, he never got a cold.
Now, these are examples of the kind of things you talk about on your podcast. Yes. I'm a big fan. It's Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. And you have sort of archived the great stories of old Hollywood from industry vets, whether they're writers, actors, producers, who are getting a little long in the tooth.
Oh, yeah.
And you have this, you said you have this problem where you book a guest and then they die before make it. How many have you lost this year before you could get them on?
I had Jack Carter booked. And the week he was supposed to do it, his manager called and said he went into the hospital. And that's never a good sign when someone that age has to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
And so he died. And I think another guest died the night before. And so I was originally going to call the show the Before It's Too Late Show. I've had some, luckily, where they died, you know, afterwards, you know, yeah. So I'm luckily they died.
So now that's like one of those things on Murder, She Wrote, where you might be the chief suspect, probably.
Yeah, oh, yes.
You're
yes.
like Angela from Murder, She Wrote. Some people keep dropping like flies every time they go on your show.
And like this character actor, Marvin Kaplan, and he's one of those, you know, he's one of those, if you heard his voice, he was one of the voices on the old cartoon Top Cat.
Oh, okay.
And he used to talk like that. And he did a great interview, and a couple of weeks later, he died. And we had Joe Franklin on.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, and a couple of other people who died afterwards.
Yeah, and I think last time we were talking about, I forget who you had who replaced Jack Carter, sort of. It was like another one of those old comedians who was kind of his rival, and the guy just kind of bitched about everyone the whole time. He brought up all these old rivalries and grudges and people who owe him money.
Well, I actually, getting back to David Steinberg, I heard he used to hang out at the Hillcrest Comedy Club when he first started.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the golf course, the golf club for Jews, because they weren't allowed in the other places that John Wayne and Ward Bond would go to. And he would sit there at these tables, and there would be Groucho Marx and Jack Benny and George Burns. Milton Berle, and they would be talking about, bitching about people from years ago.
Really?
From like the 1920s who gave them a bad review in their vaudeville show.
Really?
And like, this is like a critic who's been dead for 70 years. They're still bitching, and they're bitching about, you know, the manager of this one vaudeville house. So it never stops.
I mean, as much as you hate doing stand-up, you must at least be thankful that you didn't have to work in those days, in the vaudeville days,
because
those were brutal. Those were miserable.
Yeah. Whenever people say to me, you know, tell me your nightmare gigs, I always think the worst nightmare gigs you could have now is like a weekend in Hawaii in comparison to the vaudevillians. Like, they'd have to travel like days by train, or and they'd be sleeping in train stations, unheated train stations. And their dressing rooms would be rat-infested.
Wasn't there one that got flooded? It was like over a pier or something, and the tide would come in, and their dressing room, would they be standing in puddles of water?
Yeah, they'd be deep in ocean water.
God. Well, I have to ask about a certain scene in this documentary. You're somewhere for a gig, and you're staying in a hotel, and there happens to be, I don't know what this was, a reenactors convention or something?
It was in Chicago. There was a war it was like one of these war reenactment things. It was like where people from every war, they weren't in those wars, but there were people from the Civil War and World War I and Vietnam and some of the old religious wars. This guy with a big crucifix came over and he goes, "You're Gilbert Gottfried. Oh, I got to have a selfie with you." And my favorite, of course, was my favorite war, World War II. And so there were Nazis all over the place, and with swastikas and everything. And they were running over to me, and they'd want selfies. And I remember they were all very cheerful. They all loved me,
running to
problem
capture
child.
You?
And I thought, gee, you know, the Third Reich gets a bad rap. These are really, really friendly, nice people.
Yeah, in fact, didn't he want to tell you a joke?
Oh, yes.
He's dressed up like the SS.
I had a Nazi officer tell me a Michael Jackson joke, which is also another level of bad taste. And two of the Nazis in full regalia showed up at my comedy show.
Oh, really?
And they're sitting at a table with their drinks and their swastikas and everything. And they love the show, of course.
You might single-handedly take on the Aryan race the white nationalists in Charlottesville.
One time, I remember I was very proud of this. It was some kind of, white supremacy Nazi group that decided they're going to, to show people how much dangerous influence and power the Jews have in our society. And they printed a list of, the most powerful listen-to Jews that, must be watched out for. And my name was on the list. And I thought, this is great. I was there with Steven Spielberg and all these other major Jewish.
You should
Jewish
have shown your
producers.
Agent that.
Yes.
You're part of the Zionist conspiracy.
Yes.
I think somewhere along the way you said something like, you're not actually that religious, but you kind of have a shit deal because even though you're not a very observant Jew, you realize that you would be the first person they would load up onto a cattle car.
Yes, it's like
you
one
fit
of those,
the profile.
It's kind of like one of those things, like these Jews who disregard Judaism. They turn their back on Judaism, and I think, when they round us up again, you're going to be in a train car with everybody else. So cut the shit. Well, I remember when that whole Mel Gibson was in the news all the time, and they said he was stopped for drunk driving, and he was they found out he was a major alcoholic, and he said to this policewoman, "Hey, are you a Jew? Jews are responsible for all the wars." And then he called her sugar tits. And he said that to his wife that she should get raped by a gang of niggers. And
whoa,
he
I didn't
would
hear that one.
Yeah, he would hit her over the head with a shovel and bury her in the rose garden.
He's a real funny guy.
Yeah. And when I heard all this, all this story of all this terrible stuff, all I could think at the end was, hey, wait a second. What did he say about the Jews?
Well, before we wrap up, I love all the jokes from your Dirty Jokes album, and I've retold some of your traveling salesman jokes. I love that because that's so old school. Like, who tells doctor or traveling salesman jokes anymore?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a favorite salesman joke?
It's on my DVD, you know, which... and or if you have a Victrola, I didn't give it to you.
Okay.
Traveling salesman goes to a farmhouse. Can you put me up for the night? And the farmer goes, well, I can let you sleep in the barn. And so the traveling salesman goes, okay. And the next morning, the farmer comes in. And he goes, so were you comfortable in the barn? He goes, yeah, I had a great time in the barn. I was talking to all the animals. And the farmer goes, what are you, nuts? And he goes, yeah, I was talking to them. I spoke to your cow. Your cow said her name is Elsie. And he goes, that is her name. And he said, you milk her at like 5 o'clock in the morning. He goes, that's exactly it. And your horse's name is Otis. And he goes, that's right. And he goes, you have this broken down pail that you put that has grains in it that he eats every morning at 6:30. And he goes, that's exactly right. And he goes, and I spoke to the sheep, and the farmer goes, those sheep are lying.
Perfect. Well, Gilbert opens November 3rd at the IFC Center in New York City and November 10th at the Lemley Fine Arts Theater in L.A. and across the country. Gilbert Gottfried, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Gilbert Gottfried for joining me on the podcast. This wonderful documentary, Gilbert, A Gilbert Gottfried Story, opens in New York tomorrow, Friday, November 3rd, at the IFC Center, November 10th at the Lemley Fine Art Theater in Los Angeles, followed by theaters across the country. I also highly recommend subscribing to Gilbert Gottfried's amazing colossal podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can keep up with him at gilbertgottfried.com or on Twitter at @RealGilbert. Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? That way, you could try day trading the markets without worrying about the risk. Well, luckily, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. That's Nadex, Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. Also, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. And please take a moment to take our listener survey at podsurvey.com/kick so we can get to know who's listening, and it's also helpful with our advertisers. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.